Good afternoon. Hello.
Hello.
Good afternoon. Hello.
Hello.
Hi. It's great to see you here. And we are going to have a very different way of our discussion today and our presentation. A student came up with this idea. So before I get into that too much, I need to say that it is 5:30 on Tuesday, April the 11th. This panel, number 2956, is called Hometown Conversations, Facing the Affordable Housing Crisis, Boulder and Beyond. So tonight, it's going to depend a lot on how you feel, who you are, how you want to get your ideas, thoughts, questions in an interactive way, as though it is a conversation with these four panelists. I'm going to start with their taking time to introduce themselves and talk among themselves. So we right now can listen, and then in a little bit, be ready to get really involved. If this is going to work, and a student came up with this idea, and I think it's terrific, if it's going to work, it's going to mean that we may have to step out of our usual ways at the World Affairs Conference. And it may be just fantastic, who knows? So I have a feeling it will be. So I'd like to start with, to my left, so would you just go ahead, introduce yourselves, and I will just say that I'm Dorothy Rupert. I was a legislator here for many years, represented Boulder in the Senate and the House, and a high school counselor for 25 years at Boulder and Fairview, and I've been teaching at the university the last 15 years. So Boulder is very much a part of me, and I'd like to think I'm a part of Boulder, but you're going to find right now how much we can all be Boulder, Denver, and beyond. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Dorothy. Good evening, everyone, and thank you for joining us at this hometown discussion. And I see some of my very favorite housing junkies in the audience, and some of us just can't get enough of this topic. And by way of background, I often ask people when they got the housing bug, and when they do they remember the moment, do they remember the experience or the project? And for me, I got the housing bug in 1985 when then Mayor Correll, who was a much beloved mayor of Boulder, put me on the Housing Authority Board. I'm at the tender age of 25, and she really shouldn't have done that, but it's turned out well. So my depth of expertise and experience with this topic goes back to 32 years now, and most of it with Boulder Housing Partners. For the last 20 years, I've been its executive director. We are the housing authority serving the city of Boulder. We have 2,300 households, families who are in our portfolio. You need this louder, back row louder. Okay. Oh, that's much louder. Better? Okay, I'm not going to start over. I think this is all in your program. So, tech people, thank you. And our portfolio spans everything from homeless families to people pursuing first-time home ownership. But beyond Boulder, let me say, I also taught here at CU for several years in the College of Architecture and Planning. I taught the course in housing policy, which I loved. And I served many years as the president of the National Association of Housing and Redevelopment Officials, which is the nation's largest and oldest association that serves housing and community development professionals. So I spent a lot of time in Washington on the Hill and have a couple of pieces of legislation kind of that have maybe one period or one word that I can claim. Like I got that word in there. And then currently I'm a fellow with the Affordable Housing Institute, which is a Boston-based impact consultancy, and we're working on some breakthrough research about the nexus between housing and education. So I'm a total housing person, and I love this, so thank you for coming.
Hi, my name is Joe Hagan. I'm president and CEO of the National Equity Fund. We're based out of Chicago, Illinois. We are a 501c4, a nonprofit. We raise equity, taking advantage of the low-income housing tax credits. And for the last 30 years, we've raised a lot of equity, in total of about $13 billion of equity. I've been a housing junkie since 1997. I was a city-county planner in Athens, Ohio, which is the home of Ohio University, which, by the way, have similar problems that you have here in Boulder. So I have seen a lot of different types of housing. In fact, I have one of my first deals I did some time ago in 1993 was with the Boulder Housing Authority, and Betsy was only 15 at the time, but she was on the board.
She didn't understand anything Joe said.
But we have invested all across the United States, and also in the Puerto Rico, in the U.S. Virgin Islands, and we finally picked up a deal in Hawaii. Hopefully I'll go over there a couple times to see it. But we're actually in 320 different cities in the United States. So I've seen a lot, and I've seen a lot of different things. They asked me to come and talk about Boulder because Boulder is unique in that you have a housing shortage, not only affordable housing, but also student housing. And you have a city where it is typically difficult to get the type of housing that you need to get, in that you have, as a city, you have density issues that we have to overcome in order to get affordable housing done. And there's a very long process to get an affordable housing deal approved through the entitlement system. So we see that in some other places, for example, San Francisco, San Jose, and different parts of the country. So I'm happy to give you my input as we move along.
Hello, everyone. My name is Paula Bland. I am the Director of Residential Programs and Services on the CU Boulder campus. That is that I oversee our residence hall program, all of our residence halls on campus. I oversee our apartment group and children's services. We have a children's center on campus, and also our graduate family housing and our undergraduate apartment group, which is the Bear Creek Apartments. And then the CUSG Cost Center, off-campus housing and neighborhood relations, also reports to me outside of housing and dining services. It's not within housing and dining services. It reports to CUSG in that respect. They get their funding from our student government group on campus. I've been in Boulder specifically for almost 29 years. I came in 1988, have worked on campus and housing for that entire time, and I had 3 other years prior to this in housing at another university. I am a part and a member of our international organization. It's the Association of College and University Housing Officers International, which deals with housing, student housing specifically, all around the world. And we also work with a lot of different vendors, and also privatized housing is coming into play, what we call privatized housing, housing that is funded and built and run by private companies, usually for profit. And there are a number of situations across the country where universities have gone in the direction of participating in some type of what we call public-private partnership, where part of the solution for the university housing is what we would call a private company, privatized housing solution. So as universities go, that is a choice that some institutions are making, and we can talk about that for student housing if you're interested. There's a lot of different issues around student housing in Boulder specifically, and what is happening for students. Workforce housing is also an issue for the university, and something the university is looking at. How do our faculty and staff, who no one goes into work at the university for the millions of dollars they could receive in a salary, to be able to afford to live in Boulder. Sometimes our faculty and staff, as well as our students, are moving outside of the city and sometimes the county of Boulder because of the affordable housing issue. So it impacts our students, it impacts our faculty, and it impacts our staff. So a lot there to discuss as well.
Hello. My name is Andrew Heben. I have a background in urban planning. I completed my thesis at the University of Cincinnati on democratically organized homeless encampments, which I turned into a book called Tent City Urbanism, and it looks at how can we transition from avoiding or moving homeless encampments around from place to place to coming up with a more permanent solution, or at least a more productive solution that can help get people into permanent housing. So I am also the project director of Square One Villages. We're based in Eugene, Oregon, and it's my first time in Boulder, and I took advantage of hiking your Flatirons. I couldn't resist, went to the top today, and I think I'm suffering the consequences of that, but I'm going to try to hang in there, and I hope you guys can bear with me. I promise I've spoken on this quite a few times, so... But the mission of our organization in Oregon is to create self-managed communities of cost-effective tiny houses for people in need of housing, and we've come up with a couple different models for bridging the gap between the street and conventional housing. Our first project, Opportunity Village, is opened in 2013 as a one-year pilot project on city-owned land. And basically provides a temporary transitional model. The houses are relocatable, 80 square feet, basically detached bedrooms, and then supported by common facilities. And we were able to do the whole thing for just under $100,000. So it's an example of how a local community can come together to provide significant improvements to the situation that people are on the street are experiencing, where they have no stability, security, privacy, ability to stay warm and dry. And then the second model is more of a permanent, affordable housing model using tiny houses designed to be affordable to people with extremely low incomes. Those houses are 160 to 300 square feet, each with on a permanent foundation. Each will include a kitchenette and small bathroom, and then also supported by common buildings for a larger kitchen and community gathering area. And that's an introduction.
Thank you very much. We have a little feel right now for who these folk are, and I'm going to ask them to ask each other questions or discuss among themselves for a little bit, but be ready, because we want to hear from you. Do you have anything you want to say to each other or add?
I was going to ask Betsy, because I got to tell you, looking at different places across the United States, this is one of the best housing authorities that we've seen. It's very well run. I'm trying to figure out, it keeps getting back. I'll see. Is that better? Okay. She runs one of the best housing authorities in the country. What are you doing right now as far as affordable housing?
Thank you, Joe. I will send your check tomorrow. That's very nice of you.
You're supposed to give it to me now.
There you go. Well, we're doing everything we can, trust me, to try to stay ahead of the demand curve. So, Dorothy, I'm going to trust you to cut me off, because I can just go on and on. But, for example, one of the things that, you know, that I like people in our hometown to know is, for example, just based on the market appreciation in Boulder, right, the way the cost of homes and the cost of rent is escalating naturally with the market, we have what we call a shed rate of 1,000 affordable homes each year. So meaning last year rent might have been 750, which, you know, was relatively affordable. This year, it's 1,200, right? So our market is, the private sector is losing the ability at a pace of 1,000 units every year of responding to the housing needs of our community. As an affordable housing sector in Boulder, we're adding back 123, right? So we're a net loss of almost 900 units. So we are doing everything we can to try to backfill some of that before it's too late. It's a very expensive place to work. We just bought 185 units in South Boulder, the Tantra Lakes apartments. And so that, thank you, clap. That kind of acquisition of big multifamily properties that currently are reasonably affordable, and you know, we are trying to then not only hold the rents affordable but write them down for 40% of the units there. That will really help. We're also in the ground on in the ground meaning we're in construction on two other affordable housing properties. But even at our most furious pace, our goal is 200 units a year. We're so far short of what we need for Boulder to remain diverse, inclusive, and welcoming, which is the vision as articulated in our Boulder Valley comp plan. So we're really called to ask the hard question, if we believe by our biblical document, our comprehensive plan, that we want to be inclusive and we want to be diverse, we really have to ask ourselves, well, how courageous are we willing to be around our housing and land use policies? Because, right. Because we've got a big gap that we're not quite ready to acknowledge, I think.
So I'm going to ask about student housing. I mean, there's probably a big shortage of student housing, especially for those folks that are glad to have families. So what is going on in the student housing?
So on campus, we have about 7,000 residence hall student beds. We have a freshman residency requirement, which means all of our first-year students who are true freshmen, straight out of high school, are required to live on campus for 1 year. And I will say we do this for a number of reasons, but none the least of which is students who actually live on campus for 1 year, our records show that they are more likely to persist to graduation. So that is very important in their transition for that 19-year-old student. And we try to do a lot of things programmatically within the residence hall system to help them really get their feet under themselves in the university campus, know where the resources are, and have a sense of the Boulder community and what's out there for housing options for the second year and beyond. So first-year students right now are about 6,400 students on campus, so we don't have very many residence hall beds for more than our first-year student class. We have a few, but not many. We do have another 1,000 beds in our Bear Creek apartments that are undergraduates for the most part, sophomores, juniors, seniors. So they do have that option that is owned and operated by the university. Most of our second-year students ultimately will have to move off campus into the community. We also have a little over 800 graduate family housing apartments on campus. The inventory there, the facilities, we have not built any new facilities in graduate family housing really in a number of years. The one new building that was built and opened in 1988, we actually have converted to a residence hall because we needed it for residence hall beds. So we have a little over 800 graduate family housing apartments. Let me talk about that a little bit more. We have over 500 graduate and families on a waiting list for 800 apartments. The 800 apartments do not turn over every year, as you can imagine. We have folks come in 2, 3, 4, 5 years. If you're working on a PhD, you're not going to necessarily move. And so some folks are on the waiting list for 2 years to be able to get on campus to graduate family housing. And the buildings are not the newest in the world. They are very reasonable, probably a little under market rate at this point, but they are certainly not as nice as some of the other places in Boulder, but the other places in Boulder certainly would be newer and then have higher rent rates. Our Bear Creek apartments also have a waiting list, and I can't tell you today what that is. It's kind of in fluid as we're speaking, as people canceling and coming on. But we typically will have a waiting list of at the beginning, maybe as much as 300 students for 1,000 beds on a waiting list for our Bear Creek apartments. Again, those apartments, as it stands today, are a little under market rate, and they're all inclusive. So it includes your cable, your utilities, your everything as compared to where you would go for an off-campus housing and apartments. So there certainly is a large demand for on-campus housing. We are in the process, as we speak, building a, or in the process of designing, and we'll break ground about a year from now, on another 700-bed residence hall out at our Williams Village complex area out at 30th and Baseline. We have proposed and are in still discussion with the city and with the university about a new graduate family housing apartment complex down north of Boulder Creek in our graduate family housing area. But if you are a Boulder resident, you were here in 2013, in September of 2013, when we had our big flood event. That's probably underestimating it. But in any case, so the city and FEMA and the federal government have been looking at floodplain, floodway issues. We're still in negotiation around some of those things. And that area is certainly in considered the floodplain area, and the flood, there's certain pieces of the floodway there. So we're trying to make some decisions about that and where that goes. The university is also very conscious about, you know, other aspects of building around campus, and there are a lot of competing demands for university money. The housing department on campus is an auxiliary funded organization, a department on campus. We don't get any money from the state. We don't get any money from the federal government. We don't get any money from tuition. It's all based on room and board fees. So we are trying to build as economically as possible, but we build 100-year buildings. So that's a concern for us. We're looking into things that are what we call micro apartments. That may be a solution, and that might be something we want to talk about that will meet the needs of
maybe
folks.
Someone will have a question on that one.
Yeah.
So
that is something around the world that people are doing. Micro apartments. What does that mean? What does that look like? How do we incorporate those kinds of things? We're looking at some of those options. We're looking at, you know, we're capping our room and board rates to 3% or about CPI every year, so we don't raise room and board rates so high that students can't live with us or they can't come to the University of Colorado. So we don't try to expand our room and board rates so high that students can't come here.
Paula,
and
I want to make sure that we have questions, and it sounds like you've got lots of information for us.
You just got cut off, Paula.
Yeah. That's great.
But I want to say, you know, in the Boulder context, it's great that we have Paula here, because
right. That
one, it's such an impressive portfolio that you manage. And then for the balance of the community, we have to think about this, that here's what I think helps us create a picture. In Boulder, in the city of Boulder, we have 44,000 housing units. That's all. Of those, 23,000 are rental units. So now let's think about demand for those units. The university alone creates more than enough demand to occupy all of those units. Right? The last I checked, and Paula can correct me, there's demand from 19,000 students living off campus. Now, students don't consume an apartment or home on a one-for-one basis, but even assume three, the magic number three, you still have a big demand, and then 4,500 faculty and staff. So, you know, add that together, and you've got CU alone creating demand for well more than half of our entire inventory of rental units. So that leaves, for all the rest of us, maybe 10,000 units. And so right away, you get quickly into the supply and demand dynamic of our market. And you don't even have to talk about open space or the Flatirons or any of the other things, right? So CU, while it's such an important institution in our community, but once I really dug into that data, I thought, well, it's interesting that one of the first things we didn't do right after we platted the university in the late 1800s was create a regional housing strategy to say, okay, this fabulous institution is going to create some demand on our housing market. And just as a small thing, I went to a much smaller school, but that school had a housing policy of on campus all 4 years, because they did not want to be a factor in the local housing market. Now, see, you can't do that, but just so you get a sense of the consumption power of our university in terms of limited supply of rental units. Can you hear? I'm trying to manage the feedback.
The other thing I would mention that I think comes up is, so if we are looking at housing, faculty, staff, students, and others who are workforce within the city of Boulder, the issue of transportation comes into play as well. And that's not necessarily what we're here to talk about, but there are multiple layers to the issue that you have to recognize.
Right. Thank you. I want to just stop just a moment and introduce Stephen, who's in the front row. And I don't want to embarrass you because I want you to be known as the person who came up with this idea the first time that we've had discussions. And so I'd like, first of all, for you to have any comments or anything that you see happening here. Is this anything you thought it might be like, or what would you like to see happen?
Right.
A
right.
Very good
right.
idea.
Yeah.
We're going to...
Okay.
Okay.
I know you guys are all so quiet. There's someone over there.
Right. We're going to let see how you're feeling.
Are you feeling pretty good?
Yeah, I can. I'll keep going, yeah.
Okay, then it's wide open, Stephen. Okay? Are you okay?
Andrew?
Oh, well, I thought we were going to get a question.
Let's start with some questions. And could you stand? And
well, I am standing.
Oh.
So I can speak to the example of our model using the tiny house village. I think it is kind of I see the tiny house village as a hybrid between the single family house and the apartment building, where with a single family house, you're probably only going to get 5 units per acre. With a tiny house village, you're going to get 20 to 40 units per acre. But they still look like houses. And I think people can relate to that. And I think... just having trouble composing my thoughts. I really apologize. the altitude, I guess. 20. So basically, I think it has some of the benefits of the single family house, while not necessarily getting to the density of an apartment building. I do think density is needed, obviously. With the demand Betsy's talking about, you do need to build up to meet that demand to some degree. And I think there are ways of incorporating the tiny house village concept in an apartment building, the micro concept that you were referring to, and also SROs, single room occupancy housing. It used to be a very popular form of housing throughout the 20th century until about the 1960s to 1980s, where it was basically removed from the urban landscape. And I think it's a pretty big reason why we see the issue of homelessness the way it is today. Prior to the 1980s, it was primarily single men that experienced homelessness, and now we see women and children. And I think the deletion of that housing option has contributed a lot to the issue we're at today. And for those of you not familiar, the single room occupancy is basically a private room of 100 square feet, and then there's typically a bathroom down the hall and a shared kitchen on a separate floor. So it's a way of creating cost-effective housing.
Real quick, let me just bring up your issue about density. We work all across the United States, and what's most surprising, one of the cheapest new construction costs is in Dallas. Actually in Texas, all across Texas. And basically it's because of density. They can do up to 38 units per acre, build really nice buildings that last for a long time, generally about 3.5 stories high. Sometimes, I don't know how you define stories here. And I think that's something that you need to look at is increasing density. You can do it without it not looking bad. And it was interesting, in the Woodlands, I believe, the density was about 10 acres per unit, if I remember that correctly. I'm old now and I don't remember everything. And that's one of the reasons why it costs more. When I presented the Woodlands deal back in 1994, the cost per unit was $100,000. And when I presented it for my committee, which was located in Columbus, Ohio, they almost scratched it because they couldn't believe why the price is so high when our average cost per unit back then was $62,000 a unit. So I think one of the things you need to do, you can accommodate higher density and still make it look well, look good, and last a long time. And I think it's one of the things that through good architecture that you can figure a way to get that done. And that's one of the ways to bring down the cost of affordable housing.
Yes.
Can you give me credit for talking better that time?
Yeah, yeah. He definitely did.
And now people in our neighborhood are building homes 5,000, 7,000, 8,000 square feet for a couple. So it seems, to your point, the people, we have mega wealthy people coming in to Boulder without considering building better infrastructure for transportation, but that are building
some of it, this is great for Joe to respond to this quickly because, you know, he's more the banker, but part of, you know, so much of what's going on is the land cost driving everything. So typically if people are paying $1 million for a quarter acre lot, which is really what's going on now, right? You buy $1 million home, you scrape it, and you build a big home, then generally, mathematically, you want your vertical cost, right, your house cost to be 3 times your land. And so if you're paying $1 million for land, I don't think, you know, it's maybe selfish or greedy. You usually have to build a big, valuable house on that land.
In the back.
With due increase in land trust for private coordinating with other
we're moving more and more right now where we do not only affordable housing, but also regular market rate housing, and they're combined. In fact, we just are closing on a deal down in Dallas, Texas, which is almost about 340 units. 52% of those units will be rented to folks who earn below 80% of the area median income, and the others will be rented to as market rate units. This is our second deal that we've done in Texas that has that. It is working out extremely well on the first deal, roughly 360 units. It leased up right on time like it was supposed to. It's doing extremely well. And I got to tell you that the product that the developers built, so I want to make sure everyone understands, I'm just an investor. I'm not a developer. All of the folks we work with are generally local developers that decide how they want to get the deals done. And what we do is we invest, and then we monitor the deals for at least 15 years. We look at it on a quarterly basis from a financial perspective, and then we come out and visit it every year, and we make sure that it's complying with all the requirements of the affordable housing program. So we're moving more towards that. This is something that is probably, this is our second deal that we've done. We're very, very encouraged by it.
I would say, if I could answer David's question, in our portfolio of Boulder Housing Partners, how many of you have been to or know of the Holiday Neighborhood? Great. Good. You live in it? Oh, nice. So, sure.
This woman here has been really.
Let's keep going.
Okay,
in spite
won't
of
finish that answer.
Yeah. Let's keep going in spite of the fact that I was supposed to have had you use note cards in this session. I'm just going to, are you okay with the way it's going? Are you?
Yeah, we're all good. We're good.
Yeah, okay, good. Okay. A microphone might help. Okay, let's have another question. Who was? Do it.
All right.
Go.
My question, and I'll explain it, what do you mean by affordable? I live in an affordable housing unit, and on the first floor condo, 975 square feet, in the Holiday Neighborhood, which everybody says, well, it's so cute, 2- and 3-story row houses, and small $1 million homes used to be the Holiday Drive.
Right.
Right. We should talk after. The definition of affordable is that you're not spending more than 30% of your income on your housing. Right. And I can tell you 63% of renters in the city of Boulder spend more than 30% of their income. And 50% of the 38 million renters in this country spend more than 30% of their income on housing. 15,000 households in the county of Boulder spend more than 50% of their income on housing. So the title of the panel, right, do we have an affordable housing crisis? Yes, that's a crisis. But catch me after so we can talk about you.
That's great. Right. Did people hear that? Did you hear that?
Just so you know, all of the deals, right now we have 1,753 deals under asset management. All but about three of those are for folks who earn between 0% and 60% of your median income. Many of them, we always try to get a number of the units that we can rent to folks who earn 30% of your median income, and then 50% of your median income, and then 60%. So we are very focused on affordable housing. We're just experimenting on the two Texas deals.
Yeah, and he had asked a question in the back about middle income, which is why Joe went there. But we speak a language called area median income, AMI. So for reference, in Boulder, the area median income for a family of four is roughly $100,000. So it makes doing those percentages easy. The conventional equity tools, the free money into our deals, are available from 0 to 60% of that median. And most of them are clearly biased towards the lower end of that.
So the way it works is that's...
Did you hear the question, comment, question? Okay.
So, we can repeat them back.
But to say that the way it works is, oh, yeah, that's the first area. That's the first thing we look at. But then we look at the rent based upon one person. And so then that's how we calculate the rent for that particular unit. So one-bedroom unit is based upon one person. And a two-bedroom is three-person, et cetera. And so we can that would be more affordable if you're a one-person renter.
Right over there, the first with the hat.
Yeah.
You ask, you make me go first. I want to eliminate it. I want to eliminate the housing issue. It's going to be, meaning that everybody can be able to rent units somewhere where their cost is somewhere what they earn is less at 30% of their income. I mean, that's ultimate goal. What is really interesting, I got to tell you, is that the level of I can say innovation as a result of the Section 42 of the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit Program that was passed 30 years ago, the level of innovation that has happened between then and now is pretty phenomenal. That program wasn't supposed to work, and now we're doing everything from providing housing for people, for families, for seniors, and also people that are homeless. It's a pretty amazing that we took this program, we were able to change and make it work. We need more tools. We need help from the government in order to achieve different things and better things. We're probably not going to get it, but that would be my ultimate. That's what I would feel best about 20 years from now.
Let's go over on this side. I think.
Well, I guess ultimately what would I like to see to address this issue would be for the federal and state level to adequately fund our housing programs to address the issue. But I don't know. Well... Yeah.
Wait.
I think housing, it's a national issue and it needs to be addressed on the national level, and we need to fund our housing programs to be able to provide low-income housing for everybody. I said this statistic at a panel yesterday that I think people found pretty interesting. The Bipartisan Policy Center found that to extend our housing voucher program, the housing voucher basically allows you to, if you have a voucher, you can get subsidized housing on the private market where you're basically paying 30% of your income. Currently, only 1 in 4 people that qualify for housing assistance actually receive it. To expand that to cover everybody in this country that's earning under 30% area median income, so we call that extremely low income people, it would cost $22 billion. And so that sounds like a lot, but if you look at the way our Department of Housing and Urban Development is funded, we give $171 billion of tax exemptions to homeowners each year, primarily under the mortgage interest deduction. So I think if we want to actually address this issue, we need to cap the mortgage interest deduction, and we need to fund low-income housing. But if you look at the way HUD has been funded historically over the decades, you know, and you see a Trump administration that's proposing a 15% budget cut to that already critically low number of 1 in 4, that's about to get worse if that happens. So what I and my organization have decided to focus our efforts on is how can we develop simpler, cost-effective models that can utilize existing resources within our local community. And we've been able to do that with the tiny house because it's a scale that the average person can engage in. You can get a local builder. You can get a construction trade school to help lead the building. You can involve average citizens in the process, and you can get a project up relatively quickly if you can get past the NIMBY concerns and convince your city that it's a good idea.
Thank you. Let's go over here in second row.
Sure, yeah, I think that's an idea I've thought quite a bit about.
Andrew, excuse me, would you just say a little bit so everyone knows?
Do what?
A little bit about what she said. Repeat the question or comments.
She's basically asking, can we create a housing model that's of interest both to people with low income and people that aren't necessarily constrained by income? Yeah. So I talk a lot about how the tiny house is a way of blurring the line between the housed and the unhoused, because it provides an opportunity for people that are experiencing homelessness to drastically improve their quality of life. But if you guys have been on the internet lately or have cable television, you've probably seen that tiny houses are becoming more popular by people that aren't necessarily constrained by income as well. Our Emerald Village project is an example of permanent tiny houses. They have a kitchen. They have a bathroom. We're gearing that towards people that have extremely low income. They'll pay $250 to $350 a month, so that's actually affordable to somebody on SSI or Social Security or part-time work. But as we begin to accept applications for that, we're actually receiving interest from middle-class folks, or you know, and so I think, yeah, that's an interesting opportunity. So we're able to build this Emerald Village project off of grants and private donations, but that's not very scalable, and that's why I say we need public funding. But another idea is, yeah, could you create a community where it's internally subsidized, where you know maybe the low-income folks are paying a percentage, whereas other folks are helping to subsidize that project? It's an interesting idea.
Thank you. Right.
Oh,
I think that would be, yes, I just can't, sorry, right there.
Do you want to be more specific, just inclusionary housing in general, does it work and has it helped? Yeah, it has produced a phenomenal number of units for us in Boulder. It certainly has helped those developers who have been able to provide on-site affordable units create nice mixed income communities. I think that's how we all like to live, frankly, organically, like mixing of incomes and lots of diversity. Right. Oh, gosh, I mean, all over Boulder, certainly. So any developer who builds in Boulder must do 20% of the units as affordable. So any development bigger than 4 units has got either a cash in lieu payment or affordable housing on site. So it's all throughout. But it's been very, very powerful as a tool used all over the country. super, super helpful. And Andrew, we should talk after, because we are doing a fair number of mixed income communities in Boulder. I was starting to say the Holiday community is 42% affordable. It's a big, big mixing of incomes. Tantra will be 40% affordable, 60% middle. I think that's really nice. I think, you know, we really want to live in segregated by income communities. I think we want to know each other as who we are, regardless of income.
Thank you. Let me just see, is there anyone up? I can see you now. Sorry.
Yeah, and I'll help Dorothy by saying we want to prioritize student questions. So where are the students?
Completely.
Raise your hands. Let's make sure we are getting students' questions.
Over here.
There's one. You have a question?
Well, we're limited right now. We're limited to how much we can do every year based upon what Congress has provided. Our market is about $11 billion market of equity that we provide across the United States. And we have a lot of takers for that, in part because we provide a decent return to our investors. The good news is that we invest in a deal here in Boulder. If we provide $10 million of equity, at the end of 15 years, we walk away because we get our investors get the return because they get a federal tax credit. We're looking at other things to increase the amount of capital in the marketplace. I am a part, my parent organization is called LISC, which is a local initial support corporation. Right now, they're out in the market trying to raise $100 million. And if this works, this will provide a lot of additional funds in the marketplace. We're the first CDFI to do this, and we expect to close here shortly. But that's how you can get more money. It's not necessary. We're thinking that we can do this every year. And there's about five or six or seven other CDFIs can do it too. But it was part of that progression of us getting better and more innovative every year. And so we expect to be able to close on $100 million fund within the next 2 weeks. A community development finance organization, institution. And basically they were created 2000, I forget when they were created, but anyway, they were created as a way to have nonprofits act as a financial institutions. And LISC has been in business for 37 years. They basically have been able to get their money from banks that lend them money at a very low interest rate, and then they go back out and re-lend it to deals, especially nonprofit organizations throughout the country. And this is the first time we're actually going directly into the market and raising the money ourselves that we can then go back out and lend the money to various places throughout the United States, all affordable housing.
Let me see if there are any other students. I really apologize for not making sure students were heard. We have a question.
The question was, with the buyout option in Boulder, would it work better if the buyout option were higher or just eliminated altogether? It's a great question. It's very topical because there's been a lot of community sensitivity around the fact that developers are not providing units on site. And I think there's a part that really needs to be understood about that, which is we have a provision in law called the Telluride Law, which says we don't allow rent control in Colorado, which means the only organizations that can actually control rent or housing authorities. So with the changing of the market after the global financial crisis, when our developer production really switched from home ownership to rental, developers really don't have a mechanism to do on-site affordable because they can't control the rent. Oh, sorry. Right? So I think that what's been perceived as an unwillingness to do affordable housing on site is much more an inability to do it. So that will swing back when the market returns to home ownership and we change the construction defects law, which will also really, really help a lot. More money is exactly what we need. And one more moment for me on that, because there are two ideas I've been thinking a lot about. One is exactly Andrew's. And I want to underscore it because it's an important thing for us all to understand who care about affordable housing in this country. We need to rebalance our housing policy. And again, as Andrew said, we actually spend about $50 billion a year on affordable housing. We spend actually a little upwards of $200 billion a year in subsidizing home ownership for Americans. Now, most of that $200 billion goes to households who file a Schedule A, because you don't take the mortgage interest deduction unless you file a Schedule A, and you don't usually do that until you have income between $80,000 and $100,000 or more. So we are spending almost $200 billion a year subsidizing the housing cost for families who make more than $100,000. We need to change that. And once we change that, we will have not all the money we need, but a lot of money we need. The other thing we need to do in Colorado, I think, is to consider a real estate transfer tax, which would apply totally to Boulder. There are many of us, like me, who moved here in the 70s, bought a home. It's now worth 10x. I didn't make that value happen. When I sell my home, I should give back, because all the work that we've all done together, creating the Conference on World Affairs, supporting parks, making this an amazing community, we together gave me that value in my home. My husband's sitting back there. Dave, we're going to give some money back when we sell our home, right? That shouldn't go in my pocket. That should go back to people who need affordable housing. So thank you for that question. These are the big ideas, right? So we need political courage. We need this topic to rise in our discussions, rise in our consciousness, because the big factors are going to resist this mightily, any of these ideas.
Right down here. Can you stand? Right.
Oh, cool.
Anybody want to respond?
Well, maybe just a point. I think we've been talking a lot about the physical nature of housing and efficiencies, and that tends to be where this conversation goes. But I think maybe, you know, also considering the human aspects is also important.
Go ahead. Do you have a question? We don't have. I do. Thank you. Good question. Thank you. Someone want to take that?
We'll let Andrew talk.
That's Andrew and maybe Paul.
I think one way of doing it. So how does Boulder, what's Boulder's policies around accessory dwelling units? So I think that's one way that I've seen a lot of locales. A lot of what I'm hearing is how do you incentivize smaller development, and accessory dwelling units seems to be a possible solution. In Portland, they recently waived the system development charges for accessory dwelling units, which is pretty much the largest barrier to building small, is because our SDC fees, which go to pay for infrastructure, parks, et cetera, are pretty similar for a single, like a 6,000 square foot single family house as they are a smaller house. So is there anything being considered around incentivizing accessory dwelling units as a way to infill density while still retaining neighborhood character in Boulder?
Well, it is being considered. So we had a Housing Boulder process, which the ADU was being considered. It was put on pause until we finished the comp plan process, so it will resume. And I think one of the big sensitivities in Boulder is around parking and cars. And so people are really worried about doing cozy infill development like ADUs, because it's less the people, but it's their cars. So the more we can move to a transportation platform system, more of us using car shares and using Uber and start, you know, offloading our cars, we'll be able to pursue many, many more fabulous housing solutions, I think. You know, as a developer, people, I think they certainly do resist lower income people, and I think they resist more development, but it's cars. People really, really suffering over there are already too many cars in their neighborhood. They don't want any more, so it's a big neighborhood discussion here.
So if I could comment on that just quickly.
Sure.
I think that part of the answer to that question is also about values, about the values of our society. And I'm not a sociologist, but it's about the culture of our society and values. And how do we start talking about those values? And I have seen just probably in the last 5 years, the current college student age generation changing values in specifically in that direction towards the more minimalist values, that they don't need a lot of the things that probably my generation would say are important. Those values are changing. And the more we talk about it, the more we have these forums, the more we talk about what is important to us as a country and about our families and what we need to do in our society and in the world, and what our responsibilities are around the world, the more we can get people to understand those issues and buy into those values. So there's there's a lot of different ways to approach that issue that are that go even beyond policy or financing or what can be constructed or not. It's also about us coming together as a community and redefining our values.
And we have a question down here. Thanks.
Oh, boy. So big question, but essentially, what do I think the city will do to help ease the affordable housing problem? I know it's a really loaded question. Thank you very much. But let me turn it back to you. I do want to make sure that all of you who live in Boulder engage yourselves in the Boulder Valley Comp Plan update process right now, because the city of Boulder will do what the citizens really encourage them to do, right? They're politicians, and so it really is, where is the will of the people on the future of Boulder? So the comp plan process is all about this. How will we use our land? How cozy? I use the word cozy instead of density, right? Because it's like, we can be a little cozier, all of us in this community, certainly. So this five-year, we're in a five-year update to that comp plan is all, it's wanting to be very citizen-informed, citizen-driven. And so the more people who have an affinity and a strong desire to see more diversity and more affordable housing in Boulder really need to speak up right now. Just go to the bouldercolorado.gov website and weigh in on that process. Come to meetings, go to the council meetings, because it's all about, this will be too long. But it really is, as a developer, I'm a developer and a manager and a community builder. For me, it's all about what does it cost me to bring or buy a unit in Boulder? And there are three parts to that. There's hard cost, soft cost, and there's land. And there certainly are some interesting things being done around construction, but it's incremental in terms of bringing the price down. And the same with fees and waiving fees. It's incremental. So for me, it's all about what does it cost me to buy a piece of land? Right now, it costs about $1 million an acre when I'm out shopping. If I can put 13 units on that, my cost of land is $74,000. If I can put 20 units there, a little cozier, right, my land cost goes down to $50,000. I can start, right, being more affordable into the market. So we have to, as a community, start having some discussions about how we want to grow, and then we really need to be seeing if we can't advantage me as an affordable buyer in buying existing housing so that we can convert it from, on an inflation pace into the affordable. But I don't know what Boulder will do.
Can I say one more thing, because I think we're about ending the panel. The next 10 to 20 years are going to be transformative, and it started with Uber, and we're going to end up with driverless cars. And I, my three-year-old grandson might never drive a car. That is how close they are to making some significant differences, and it will affect every community. It will benefit Boulder because they won't need as many cars. Parking won't be an issue. I had one was speaking with an analyst, and he says, the next best thing you should do in big cities is go out and buy those big, huge parking garages, because you're going to be able to tear them down and build housing there. Because you won't need as many cars anymore. So I think as we will end that by saying that's the next big thing that we're going to see. And if Uber was only a couple years old, and it really has transformed a lot of things in Chicago, I use Uber all the time. I don't drive anymore. And I think you're going to see that throughout America.
And how about the last two? We were almost over. So do you have something, do you have any last minute things you'd like to say?
Oh, one thing I was just thinking, since I didn't do a very good job of introducing our organization, I have brochures if anybody's interested in learning more.
I don't have any other comments. Thank you.
Thank you for inviting me.
Anything? Yeah. I think that we've just barely, you know, I mean, here we are, just talking together. I hope that it inspired you to get to City Council, to write, to think, wherever you live, wherever you are, have your voices heard. And I want to thank the panel, and you were a great, great audience. Thank you.